From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when researchers at Penn State University explored the subject of gender roles and expectations and made some surprising findings. They conducted three studies that involved nearly 1,000 people. Researchers wanted to know, what behaviors did they view as traditionally masculine or feminine? During two of the studies, here's how it worked. Participants would read a summary of daily activities. Then they rated the activities that they felt had a particularly gendered bent to them. And it turns out that all the environmentally based activities were viewed as being feminine, including recycling. Professor Janet Swim explained to The Independent, quote, "If being seen as heterosexual is important to a person, and it is to some men, that person may prioritize gender-conforming over gender-nonconforming behaviors in anticipation of how others might see them." In other words, the professor explains, some men express concern that recycling looks too feminine or gay. And that perception can hold men back from doing such things as buying permanent coffee cups or bringing bags to the grocery store or using a recycling bin. The study was published in the journal Sex Roles. So what exactly have we come to? Our guests are going to try to help us sort all of that out. And in a moment, I will introduce the panel that we have in studio. But first, let me introduce another guest who's interrupting for just a moment because it's a big day in the WXXI family. City News has a new editor, and it's David Andrietta, who has been with the Democrat and Chronicle for a number of years and will move into that role in just a few weeks. Hi. Welcome.
Hi.
How are you?
Thank you. It's a big day. Big day.
Well, we're just going to say hello for a few minutes because I know that you and I will have a lot to talk about in regards to what City is covering and the work that you're going to be doing. But this is big news in this community. There were many, many applicants for this job, and I know City chose it very carefully. What does it mean to you to take this role as the new editor of City?
Oh, gosh. City and WXXI are vital institutions to this city and the entire greater Rochester community. It is an honor and a privilege to be part of this family. The pairing of those two offered them, both organizations, an unprecedented opportunity to borrow the best from each other. And I'm looking so forward to being part of that cross-pollination and exercising some new skills in the process.
Jeremy Mole, our colleague, has been elevated to the position of news editor, and there is, I think there's a lot of excitement in that building because there is obviously continuity. You're a new face in that particular place, but you're not coming in necessarily to blow it up or start fresh, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. There are so many things, more than not, that City does exceedingly well. Its arts and culture coverage is second to none. The market is cornered. No one's touching this anymore. That's one area that I think is thriving. Jeremy Mole's reporting, Tim Macaluso's reporting, they are terrific writers and reporters. Their explanatory reporting is beyond reproach. I couldn't be more thrilled to be working with both of them.
Now, I don't know if you want to break any news on what you plan to focus on first. You want to wait a little bit before we get there?
I'm going to have to wait on that.
Okay.
But, I mean, my priorities are, I would say, enhancing the investigative work of City. They do excellent explanatory reporting. Jeremy Mole, as an example, if you haven't read it, you should in recent weeks. He wrote a fantastic story about bail reforms that are coming down the pike in 2020. That is the kind of reporting that no one else has touched. It is critically important to our community. I want to build on that type of reporting and look for these stories that and these types of injustices that are ongoing, that are being overlooked and not being addressed. In this case, it has been addressed, and he did a wonderful job explaining how and what the impact will be. I want to find those stories that are missing, that are going overlooked, and that we can bring to light and get ahead of and get the powers that be at least talking.
Before I let you go here, you didn't just come on here for some softballs, right? So here's the journalistic hat. You ready for this? So it was a couple days ago on this program that I had who was going to be your old boss, Michael Killian, on this program.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you this. Michael Killian is, in my estimation, pretty different as the executive editor of the Democrat and Chronicle than his predecessor, Karen Magnuson, who was sort of a very nice person but always told a really sort of flowery story about what was happening in that newsroom even when the axe was falling. Michael Killian is a lot more blunt about the state of the industry, and I think he's a very straight shooter and, at least from I can tell on the outside, a very capable person in a hard role. I said on this air then, I say it a lot. I think if people in this community can afford to be members of WXXI, if they can afford a subscription to the Democrat and Chronicle, they need to do it for the future of journalism. I think print's vital. But City is pretty well positioned in a community where it's tough in the Democrat and Chronicle. You've been there. So I'm not going to ask you to sort of like throw dirt on anything, because you've got great colleagues over at the DNC who are doing remarkable work to this day. But how hard was it to be there when you saw those cuts over the years?
It has had a profound effect on me. I mean, I've been there for 11 years, and I can say with certainty over 11 years, every year there was a layoff, a buyout, or a furlough. And over the years, it becomes tough. The newsroom has shrunk, and there are dedicated people there trying to do their jobs, serving the community, and having a tougher and tougher time of it. Look, the Democrat and Chronicle, I would still argue in terms of output and its robustness, its news coverage is still the most robust in the community. But it has left areas of the city and the greater community untouched because it just simply doesn't have the resources. And I think that's where organizations like City and WXXI, as they expand, can fill those roles. I also want to echo what you said about Michael Killian. He was very gracious in accepting my resignation. He gave me a vote of confidence in accepting this job. And, you know, as far as the DNC goes, it's been a home away from home for me for the better part of 11 years. I would be nothing without the Democrat and Chronicle. Its editors, including Mike Killian and his predecessor, Karen Magnuson, showed a level of trust in me that I'd never had before. They were very hands-off. They trusted my news judgment. And everything I've done, from some of the best work and the work that I'm most proud of to my greatest flubs, which happen. Have been because they gave me that leeway, and I'm forever grateful for it.
All right, so lastly, for those who have, in this community, somehow never picked up a City, or maybe they walk by it, they'll see the cover, and they've thought about it. I think we're at a really interesting time. WXXI is growing, is strong. City has new leadership, but a team in place. And you'll get to know them more as we have with WXXI. They're phenomenal.
I'm looking forward to that. I've known a number of them over the years and intersected with them in my coverage over the years.
So when people pick up a City, if it's for the first time in the coming weeks and months and years to come, what do you want them to find in it?
I want them to find must reads. I want this community to say to each other, hey, did you see what was in City? And if they don't know what City is, I want them to find out. City needs to be that must read that we've lost in this community, given the shifting media landscape. That is what I envision for City going forward.
David Andreatta is the new editor of City, announced today, and the WXXI family is growing, and proud to have you. And let's talk a lot more. Let's make a regular thing of this.
You got it. I would love that. Thank you very much,
David.
Evan.
Thank you. That's David Andreatta, and you can obviously follow him in all the normal places, and you'll find him in City soon. All right, David's going to evacuate that seat, and maybe if you want to take your notes with you, find a recycling bin on the way out there, Dave. You're not too much a man for that. Well, this is such a weird world we live in. I got to say, as I introduce our guests there, just to sort of reset what we're talking about here. When I first saw the headlines, I kind of thought it was an Onion article. Men might think it's too gay to recycle. First of all, is gay a pejorative in 2019? Second of all, what are we talking about here? I mean, recycling is probably gay and straight and poly and bi and trans and A and whatever. I don't think it's a thing. It's just, but apparently I'm wrong, because Penn State in this research found that men in particular are concerned that, can be concerned that recycling and pro-environmental behaviors are feminine, and men who are concerned with expressing their heterosexuality might be worried about literally just by having a permanent coffee cup or using a recycling bin. So, men, what is wrong with us? That's what we're going to figure out this hour. Let's say hello to our guests. In studio, Rowan Collins is a local educator who has done work for the Out Alliance, among many others, has done work in local school districts and for organizations. Always great to have you. Thanks for being back here.
Yeah, absolutely. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Peter Bartula, who is president of Computer Systems Asset Disposal. Tell us what that is briefly, Peter.
We take back decommissioned IT assets from the largest companies in the area. We refurbish them and upcycle them versus recycling and resell them to eBay and other sources and wholesale markets so that our customers can get some money, and also we divert all that flow from the recycling stream. People don't realize that electronics represent only 0.5% of all the volume in landfills, but 70% of the toxic chemicals.
Thanks for being here. Also with us is Jim Tappan, who's part of the faith-based outreach team at the Citizens Climate Lobby. Did I get that correct?
That's good.
Yep. Great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Glad to hear.
Also with us is Professor Mark Primus. Dr. Primus is a professor in the Department of Social Work at Nazareth College. Welcome back. Nice having you here.
Thank you very much.
Well, let me just kind of start with you, Professor, and I want to ask all of our guests. Did you, like me, see this headline and think that must be an Onion article, that's not a serious study? Because apparently it is a serious study, and that you do have some view that these behaviors are feminine, and some men might find that concerning. Did that surprise you?
Initially, in reading it, but then within that context of doing a little bit of research.
Keep talking, Professor. I'm going to adjust your mic.
Once I read that article, then I realized that they have really done quite a few articles back, even going back into the 70s, regarding how gender view things like recycling or looking at things that have to do with the environment. And so I found that surprising initially, but then when I actually started looking to it, it's actually something that a few researchers have actually been looking at for quite a while.
It would be easy for me, and I'm really tempted to say, men, are we that fragile? What is happening here? But, you know, I mean, I guess there's a segment of the population that has this worry about image in some way.
Yes. I mean, obviously, it goes way back into the whole idea of gender socialization and how we socialize girls and boys and so forth. I just was talking to a colleague coming earlier today, and she said that she sees every now and then across from where she lives a husband taking the recycling bin and dumping it into the green big container. So somehow someone in the home have went through the work of separating these things within the recycling bin. And so the assumption, obviously, is within the context of gender being the wife. And what she might not know that this, you know, the person is actually dumping it right back into the regular green bin. But either way, yes, this does happen in terms of how we socialize boys and girls. And that's how we continue to see that even today.
Peter, any surprise when you saw the headline in the study?
Yes, it's downright shocking to me. I'm also on the board of directors for the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, and we're attempting to achieve carbon neutrality by 2027 in the Rochester area. And to think that people would view recycling as anything but doing the right thing for the environment and for our community is mind-boggling. It's like, how can you say that that's effeminate to put a piece of paper into a recycling bin instead into your garbage? So I don't know where they came up with that from, but to me as a man for all my life, I've never felt one bit of, you know, that being feminine or masculine because I'm putting something in the recycle bin versus the garbage.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole separate question there of even if somehow it were effeminate, is that a bad thing, or is that thing to be avoided? But let's just start with what Rowan think. What was your response to the headline in the story?
For all my years having done education around gender expectations, identity and expression, nothing surprises me anymore about people's expectations of what is and is not masculine or feminine or somewhere in between. So I was unfortunately not surprised by that particular headline, but I think deeply disturbed by what the implications are, not only for our understandings of gender, but for the future of the planet. If we just can't get people to recycle, which is a very simple thing, as some of our guests have already said, simply because of this expectation that something that's effeminate is somehow less than or worse, I think we have a bigger problem on our hands.
What do you think is inside the minds of a man who's expressing this concern that it's viewed as too effeminate or not even hetero?
Well, I mean, there's probably a lot going on. I wouldn't be able to say all of what might be in someone's mind, but I think that there's such a large kind of top-down message in our society that, you know, male and masculine is best, women secondary always. And so if you have been born into, you know, masculinity and maleness in our society, you should never give any of that up. And so knowingly doing something that is seen as quote-unquote feminine or something like that would be willingly giving up some of that masculinity, which is kind of the ultimate no in our society still. I mean, I think that's kind of shaped some of that toxic masculinity that we see in people. You know, and then we have that kind of that second there, the equation of, you know, gay and effeminate as though they are one and the same, which we know is not true.
Right, but as an educator, and again, I think maybe the youngest on the panel, and someone who's been in many school districts,
yes.
Here's an honest question that I have. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, the word gay was a regular pejorative word. You know, that's so gay.
Sure.
Is that still a thing? And I ask that honestly. Do kids still say that?
It is. It is still a thing. It is definitely less of a thing than even when I was in school.
Okay.
And, you know, at the beginning of doing the work that I did, I was not too far out of school, actually. And so I was surprised how far we've come in the last 10, 15 years even. But it is still a pejorative word. I think it gets people aren't allowed to get away with it as easily as they used to be. When I was in school, it was just part of the vocabulary. It was everyone's vernacular. And there was literally no recourse, especially coming from teachers. But now I think there's a little bit more of a, you know, there are consequences to some language, but it's still being used. And I think that the, you know, people get creative with language. They may have moved away from saying something is gay, but they'll be able to make that message heard in some other way. And that message still get across to people. And so that gender policing is still happening in that sort of, you know, seeing gay and effeminate being the same thing.
Okay. Jim, what did you make of this piece in the study?
I was totally blown away. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a joke when I first read it. And I'm like, I have a couple of gay children. I have a lot of friends who are in the gay and lesbian community. And I never think of them as different. I really don't. And I think, you know, we're in the 21st century. It's become very well accepted, and I guess not. but this is such an important issue. I mean, climate change and all of this stuff is what I'm interested in getting at and fixing. And I can't believe that people think that that's effeminate to be concerned about the climate and the planet. You know, we live in this planet, and all of us live here, whether they're men or women, whether we're gay or straight, it doesn't really make any difference. And I just was totally flabbergasted when I heard about it. And when I was asked to come on to the panel, I'm like, I'm not sure what I can say other than, come on, men, stand up and be a man. You don't have, it's not an effeminate thing. Let's fix the planet.
But again here, I can't help but wonder, and I think our guests generally agree with this, but even if you have to tell men, hey, it's not effeminate, I think, first of all, it's not effeminate, but why is effeminate, to Rowan's point, considered some sort of a problem? So where do we start changing that? You know, if we agree, and sorry, listeners, that if I sound like I'm sort of on a high horse here, but the notion that something that's effeminate is bad, it annoys me just as much as the notion that pink is a color for girls annoys the hell out of me. Because that is a nurture and not nature thing. But where do you start even unwinding this idea that something, these kind of daily activities could be gendered and that gender could be a negative thing?
That's a tough question. And I think that's why it's been such a struggle and why we still have these conversations about what is and is not masculine and feminine, and why we kind of assign values to each of those things. You know, why we have surveys where we ask, would you consider recycling feminine? And people say yes. And thus meaning it's something that I don't want to do or I don't want to be seen doing, because then what are people going to think of me because of that? So I think it's down at the root of what we think about gender in our society and how kind of, for lack of a better word, how binary we've made it. You know, that we can have a list of everyday activities and say, can you sort these into masculine and feminine? And people, by and large, agree on what they think is this or that, when in fact, most of this is, you know, what we owe to our planet, what we owe to our communities, what we do to keep our houses clean, what we, you know, do to just be good neighbors and good people in the world. And so it really is kind of getting down to the root of what do we consider to be gender, and why is it so important that some, you know, people stay in those lines and those boxes, and what would happen if they didn't?
Okay, Professor?
Yeah, I think, too, it goes beyond the idea of recycling, because it's really more about this idea of how you are perceived by others, almost like this concept, what Mead calls a generalized other, where you're just kind of really doing something because you are worried about the perception that you're going to get from others. So therefore, if you recycle, which seems to be more of what they call a private sphere kind of thing, where women are really kind of doing more of the work in the home and recycling and so forth, you then see that through the socialization. I mean, as boys, we are socialized to really kind of blow things up, basically, in terms of play. And when with girls, they are more doing things that are more cooperative or displaying more compassion within their form of play. And thus, it gets to this point where Carol Gillian calls the ethic of care, where your girls are socialized through this concept of gender to be more caring and considerate when deciding on decisions that have to do with not only themselves, they also consider others within that concept. So that could be also broadened in this idea of trying to look at how we're protecting the planet or whatever else might be a broader aspect. But it came down to a smaller piece within this context of recycling.
Okay, Peter?
There's also another aspect, I believe, that plays into this, is if you look at that fact that 30% of the population, according to studies, don't believe climate change exists in the United States. And there's also people that feel that there is no need to recycle because of that. Then that also plays into that stereotype. A lot of these people might be the same people that do still consider, you know, femininity and masculinity appropriate, or that homosexuality is inappropriate. I don't know, but I do see that as a percentage of the population that still would throw those things, as they were said, other panelists were saying before, they'll just throw it right in the garbage because they don't care, because climate change isn't real.
That's an interesting observation, and I would also say, to state the obvious, recycling is not going to be the thing that stops climate change. There's a lot of different things here, and when we talk about changing energy systems, often I hear the pushback being along the lines of, well, you're not going to take away my car. You're not going to make me get on a rail line. You're not going to make me stop eating steak. And we have created a patina of gender around some of that, though the question, again, that I want to continue to explore with our guests is, how much is nature versus nurture? And I know this is sensitive. I know when we see these broader conversations about the study of gender, there is, I think, sometimes straw man arguments. You know, sometimes people say, oh, you're trying to say there's no difference between men and women or boys and girls. I almost never hear that. What I often hear is the perceived differences that are nature are very often chalked up to nurture. Who likes what colors? Because, by the way, pink used to be the boys' color. It used to be. Who likes what colors? What activities? And that's kind of at the core of this. And then you start to see the consequences. Are you willing to give up your car? Are you willing to recycle? Are you worried about what that means to you as a man? But on the other side of this, we've got Walter on the phone, who thinks that there's something more political about this and maybe less gender. Go ahead, Walter. Hi, Walter. Are you there? Oh, we should tell you. Listen on the phone and not the radio. Go ahead, Walter.
Okay. Hi, Evan. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Go ahead.
Great. Great discussion today, and I think some of your panels started to touch on this, but the first thing that came to my mind is, you know, we're socialized sexual, you know, for sexual orientation starts early in life, you know, which camp do you fall into and what the rules are. But also, I think that we're politically socialized. our family is Republican, you know, and so the perception might be, you know, If folks are more of the liberal, they're the tree huggers, you know, they're the sort of weak ones, and you know, I don't want to fall into that camp ideal. And then on the other end, you know, the conservative ideal, maybe the ultra conservative, that there is no problem, you know, it's all a political ploy. There's no real harm going on to the environment. So I think it's not only sexually socialized, but we're politically socialized and sort of stay in the camps that we're socialized in. And, you know, the ones that are more recycling might be seen as more the liberal, extreme, hippie, you know, sort of mentality that a lot of men probably wouldn't want to be associated with, even though recycling would be great for everyone and the planet. So it's just my comment, my observation.
Okay, yeah, so Walter, thank you. And before I kick it to the panel, I'm reminded of a phone call from a listener named Mary. Several years ago, we were talking about the efficacy or not of abstinence-only education. And a woman named Mary sent me an email and said, you know, that her view was that God created men and women to be different, that women's role in life was to bear children and to be good partners to the men whose role is to go out and earn livings and provide for families. And that in Mary's email, evangelical Christians see gender roles much more distinctly than, in her view, modern liberals. And that there's nothing wrong with gender roles, and that they're going to fight to preserve and protect those gender roles which are logical and God-given. That was the email from Mary several years ago. I've never forgotten that email. And, you know, that doesn't mean that all evangelical Christians are politically to the right, though certainly that tends to be the case, as you see in the reporting of the Washington Post in the last week. So his point is he sees it as more political, or at least tied to politics. I mean, I'll ask, do you, Jim?
You know, I see all kinds of people in the activist circles that I travel in, and there are a lot of women, but there are just about the same number of men in most of the organizations.
I think Walter's saying, though, that if you're an activist for the environment these days, you're likely to be a liberal, and if you sort of laugh at that, you're likely to be a conservative.
I think I tend to agree with that.
Okay, Rowan?
Yep.
I mean, I think there may be some kind of truth to that generalization. Yeah, there may be some overlap there. Obviously, we can't assume that everyone is in one or the other. Again, that kind of unnecessary binary of things. There's going to be people who are in the middle who, you know, kind of lie outside of our expected norms of what their political leanings may be. But I think there is definitely some overlap in that sense.
You agree with that, Peter?
Yeah, unfortunately, that is the case. And it's important for us to step outside of our political beliefs, outside of our religious beliefs, to focus on what really matters, which is saving our planet. You know, if we don't do something about this, our kids might not have a habitable world. And that, you would think, would be above people's political or religious beliefs, wanting to be able to live in a world that is habitable. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. Dr. Primus, what do you think?
Yes, obviously there's some of that there. But again, it cannot be just generalized. And you definitely need to continue to look at the fact that individuals and families make those particular decisions on their own, regardless of political viewpoints. And that's really how we need to continue to start focusing on that and looking at how people actually do, regardless of their political stance.
I have a mountain of email that I'll get to in a moment, but let me grab another phone call. Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Evan, I know every time I call, probably I date myself, but I remember Nixon, Richard Nixon, a real man, created the EPA. He was a law and order president, anti-hippie, but that was so long ago, I guess people have thought that a real man, you know, they've forgotten, created the EPA. So it's gotten somehow viewed as caretaking and looking to the future. And when you think about the way we divide gender roles in its extremity, women are the caretakers. They maintain. And children, the next generation, that's women's work. And I think it divides like that. I mean, what is women's work often? We do the volunteer work. We do things without pay, sometimes without status, simply because it needs to be done. And, you know, I've heard, disappointingly, a lot of men that, I'm not doing that, I'm not getting paid for it, attitude. And so they're not a citizen of the planet. They don't seem to have that socialization. So it gets down to, I deplore the media for making a man is required to have a AK-47 or an AR-15, and all those movies that supported that, Schwarzenegger and the list of them, it's as though you got to be a tough, tough guy to be a real man. Anyway, I'm going to shut up now and hang up. Thank you.
Jane, I agree with you. I'm raising a 7.5-year-old boy. He's an amazing kid. But it's work to start to counter some of this that starts to come into their sphere pretty early in life. Through other kids, through kids at school, sometimes through school lessons. And I'm going to build on Jane's comment before I kick it to the panel with an email from Rebecca in Chilai, who says, as the parent of a little boy age 6 and a little girl age 3, I can tell you that people have no problem with girls doing quote-unquote masculine things. My daughter wears blue, she likes trucks, etc. But people definitely have a problem with boys doing, quote, supposedly feminist things. My son has a pink puffin shirt that he loves, and after wearing a pair of hand-me-down leggings from his female cousins, he loves to wear leggings. So when he wears his rainbow leggings and pink puffin shirt, kids don't really care, But a lot of adults seem to care. They never say anything to him, but will make comments to us, some supportive, but some less so. But the people are commenting on it at all says something. As a society, we've come a long way with getting rid of expected roles, interests for females, but I think we've got more ways to go for males. We tell our daughters they can be president. Do we tell our boys that they can be a stay-at-home dad, a figure skater, or something else we think of as feminine? That's from Rebecca in Chilai. That is an interesting observation. Because I will say this, Rebecca. My son's hair is pretty short now, but for a while he wanted to wear it long. He had it down to the middle of his back. You know who would make comments? Not his friends. Other parents would be like, you know, he's going to get teased. You shouldn't do that. I was amazed by that. And you're nodding over there. It was the adults that she finds that give grief to her son who wants to wear pink. What do you make of that?
Yeah, absolutely. That was my continual experience in all the work that I've done with local school districts over the last 6 or 7 years. The older you are, the longer you have had to internalize the messages that you've been given, the socialization that you've had, the kind of overarching myths that you have been, you know, treated to throughout your life about, you know, what men are supposed to be, what women are supposed to be, and it's harder to undo them. And so I think that, you know, if we can teach, you know, when we were able to talk to school-age children, it was like kind of a no-brainer to them, like, yeah, why do we care who's wearing what or who looks like what? But when we were working with, you know, teachers and administrators, there was a lot more pushback. There was a lot more resistance to the idea that, you know, people can be whatever they want to be and they just continue to be that way regardless of whether you like it or not. And so, yeah, I think there's absolutely a lot of pushback when it comes to gender roles from, you know, from older generations. You've had longer to sit with these ideas of socialization, what is and is not okay.
Yeah, and Professor Primus, I think of kids in this situation where the kids are fine with it, but the more they hear it from adults, the more that 6-year-old becomes an 8-year-old who no longer thinks a boy can wear pink, or a 10-year-old who no longer thinks a boy can play with dolls, or a boy could become a nurse, pick whatever gendered assumption role that society has. Is there, what's the damage or the harm that you see coming
out
of
it? That occurs too, as you're mentioning, around middle childhood, where, you know, when the child gets into an age of probably around 7, 8 or so, then those kind of roles really start to get solidified through the idea of how it's presented to them by, most of the time it's through social learning, where you have adults around, you have teachers around, and they just kind of reinforce. You look so beautiful in your dress. And then if you're not wearing that, oh, you know, they give you a different message, so they reinforce and not. And so therefore, you learn, those are the expectations, those are the things that you do. You know, boys don't cry if you skin your knees and, you know, pick you up. So all of those things you are learning. And Sarah Bem over in she's passed now, but she's over in Cornell. Her and her husband did a really good thing. They called it psychological androgyny, where they try to raise their children in an environment where they did not do any kind of gender tasks. So the parents did everything. The other did cooking, cleaning. They both went to work and so forth. And boys were able to wear the barrettes in their hair, and girls were able to wear jeans or whatever. And so they found that once they were out of that bubble, and now getting into school, that's when a lot of those things started to occur and started to come up, where gendered roles started to get pushed on them. And so, again, as you get into the middle childhood, then you get into a frame where the children are already socialized by their parents. So thus, they are going to push that socialization on the ones that might have been brought up a little bit differently than they have.
Well, let's take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to your phone calls and emails, of which they are legion. But I think we've gotten past at least the recycling portion of this. Recycling's not feminine or masculine or anything. It's just a thing that you can do or not do. And before the hour's out, by the way, Peter Bartula is going to tell you where you can dispose of some of your other things that you think you can't even recycle, which is also really cool. It's part of why I wanted Peter here. He's a man who recycles. Imagine that, Penn State researchers. So Peter Bartula is the president of Computer Asset Systems Asset Disposal. Rowan Collins is a local educator. Dr. Mark Primus is a professor in the Department of Social Work at Nazareth College. Jim Tappan is part of the faith-based outreach team for the Citizens Climate Lobby. And we're right back to your feedback next. Welcome back to Connections. Let me get to your phone calls. And this is, I think it's Celia in Webster. Do I have the name right, Celia?
Yes, you do.
Well, thanks for calling.
Perfect.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
So I wanted to say that I am 17, and I'm president of my Green Club, and I think that having gender roles for climate is completely a generational thing. Like in Gen Z, people couldn't care less. I would say our attendance is 50-50 male and female, and like other people that don't identify. Additionally with that, I would say I know more guys that have started green clubs and that are in charge of green clubs in my generation than I know girls. And yeah, it's pretty equal, and I don't think anyone cares or looks down. I would even say I know girls who are attracted to guys more so if they like guys, because they care about the environment. Like, that is a good thing. I think we realize that.
Definitely this, sexy.
We need sure. to care about this.
Now, listen, Celia, I want to say something, though, that I think is, and I don't mean to be controversial with this, but, you know, you're part of Gen Z. A lot of my generation thinks that millennials are the new adult generation. We're past millennials now. It's Gen Z, as you mentioned. And the research does show something interesting, which is that young Republicans, young conservative-minded people, people your age, people in college age, they are much more likely to agree that climate change is real and that agree that it is urgent than their conservative or Republican parents or grandparents. That is true. But when you bring up the fact that at your school, the people who are doing green clubs and stuff like that are just as likely to be boys, are you talking about boys who you think probably have the same kind of views on most issues or politics that you're sort of developing yourself? Or would you even say conservatives or Republicans? Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic question. So I go to Thomas in Webster, which is by far conservative. And I would say I have many friends that just are completely conservative that come to our cleanup events and things because we realize, like, we have to get our act together or we're not going to have an Earth. Like, the Earth is supposed to warm 14.4 degrees Fahrenheit by the year 2100. And that's a problem if we don't do anything. We're all going to be around for that. We don't want that. So definitely there's a shift in that I am seeing.
So are you an optimist on this issue then, Celia?
Some days.
thanks for listening and thanks for calling. Awesome stuff.
Of course. Thank you so much for talking about it. Have a good one.
You got it. That's Celia calling from Webster. And in some sense, you can feel the energy and the optimism. And I do want to ask our guests, particularly who do this kind of work. You know, Jim, in CCL, you've got members and who've got kids. You've got young members, older members. Do you feel the energy and maybe the view of the urgency of this issue in the younger generation that maybe isn't always there with older generations?
Absolutely, absolutely. We've been very active within Citizen Climate Lobby to reach out to high schools and colleges and get those people involved because, like Celia, they do recognize that they're the ones who got to live with it more so than older generations.
Yeah.
So my grandchildren, I'm concerned about what their life is like and it's going to be like, and they are also, whereas my children are interested and concerned, but not as much. It's not as critical to them, but obviously it is because it's critical to their children. But it's definitely the younger people are really starting to take an active role, and we've got some people around the world who are making a huge impact by climate strikes and things like that are coming along, and so that's a way to try to get everybody involved, but it's being led by the young people.
Well, Rowan, in the many districts you've been in, the reason I asked Celia that question about whether the friends and the boys particularly who are involved in these green clubs, et cetera, might be conservative or Republican is just because, I think it's all good for us to recognize our own bubbles that we can be in. Mm-hmm. And I think her answer was really insightful there, not only thinking about the political leanings of her school district at large or largely speaking, but also when I think about the more rural districts, which tend to be more politically red and that you've been in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with Celia that we are seeing at least a little more balance of this, the urgency here in the younger generations?
Yeah, I think so. I think she's she had a very insightful comment there. It was kind of, this goes beyond our political leanings, whatever we want to call them. This is my fellow panelists have spoken to this already this hour, that this is our Earth, our home. We get this one. And there's things that we can do to make sure that it is inhabitable, not only for our own generation, but for generations afterwards. And so that has to go beyond our political affiliations, you know, the party that we, you know, vote for and things like that. And I've definitely seen that in the rural districts, in the suburban districts, and even in inner city districts as well. There's it kind of goes across the board in lots of ways, especially with younger generations.
Well, calling from Penfield, Dean says he's a conservative and he recycles. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Well, I feel like I'm living in a George Orwell novel in the Ministry of Love, where the conservatives are really the folks in the mainstream who believe in global warming and trying to do something about it, believe in not cutting down the forest, and believing trying to make a positive change with the recycling. And every time we allow the alt-right to say that they are conservative, we've got to call them out on it. The rest of us are conservatives. The majority are conservative in our thought about global warming, and those are the radicals. Those are the extreme nut jobs on the right. They are not at all conservative. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, can you stay there for one sec, Dean?
Sure.
So, again, I think I want to repeat this and make sure I understand the point, that you think the alt-right and people of that sort of directional belief have maybe sort of hijacked the image or the modern conversation about conservatism in this country, and it's not representative of you and other conservatives?
Well, remember, I'm a liberal conservative, if you want to use the term liberal. I think all the mainstream and people on the left are being pushed to this leftist label that's wrong. We cannot allow them to define the terms for the majority of people. By calling themselves conservative, that was old school. Maybe that was the case 50 years ago when I was a Republican. But I'm in the late 60s now, and I cannot stand someone like Trump calling himself a conservative, because he clearly is not. He's a radical, and he's a fascist, if anything.
Okay. Dean, thanks for the phone call. I do appreciate taking the time to call, and just a data point of one, but there's someone who says, look, don't generalize so much here that you're tiring a conservative movement as, hey, what's at the root of the conservative movement? You would think that there is an interest in environmentalism and that it shouldn't be political. Maybe Celia's generation does give us hope that it will not be a political issue. And frankly, Dean, a very different generation, but says it is not for him as a self-identified conservative. So let me get back to some of your emails. And boy, just a lot of fire about this. See, look here, Dean. Carl writes to say, why do you think a lot of guys have the super big pickup trucks? From my perspective, it's to prove they are a man. A pickup truck makes you a man. Does it? I mean, I know women who drive pickup trucks, and I know men who drive smart cars and bike to work. They're men. I mean, but that's kind of what we're talking about here, isn't it, Dr. Mm-hmm. Primus? I mean, I'm not making fun of Carl. I'm sort of having a little fun with this idea that if you're a man, you got a pickup truck, because and to some degree, the marketing, the ad companies, they play to that too, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's just part of what our society is. We are a kind of a male-oriented society, and so thus you find that a lot of our policies and just behaviors and things we see on TVs and media, it's all pushed toward this idea of presenting this binary kind of idea of male, female, and pushing the idea that you have to be one or the other, and there's no fluidity to it. And so it continues to push and separate those two ideas, that these are tasks for men and these are tasks for women. And it continues to be reinforced every day in many, many different ways.
Well, I mean, Peter Bartula, in a past life, you even wrote a book on dating, I have found. Is that right?
Yes, that is true.
Many moons ago.
Did many TV and radio shows about that. And it's funny the way it does tie into dating, as one of the panelists said earlier, is that I think in today's society, women do feel more comfortable that a man should be recycling, and it's an endearing quality versus a feminine quality. And I see that, like, when you're doing something nice for a significant other or something that they respect, women typically have a higher moral platform than men do. So if you're at that same platform, then they love you more and care about it more. So I don't think it's the opposite.
Yeah, and so when you say it should be, it's not a gendered activity, recycling, I would just say showing care for the planet is a thoughtful thing, and that people probably want to date other people who are thoughtful, you know, who, as opposed to selfish, myopic, or otherwise. Fair?
Totally agree.
Okay. That was many moons ago, wasn't it? What was it, year 2000 that book came out?
Yeah, around there. Still available on Amazon. Not a gratuitous plug or anything there.
Dave writes and says, the fact that far too many men are very insecure and very immature, wanting to be bullies, sadly comes to mind for me. I sure hope we can get far more men far better at basic thinking one of these days. Well, that's kind of what is at the core of this, Dave, and I appreciate that email. Because if it is 2019 and we still have scientific studies showing that some percentage of men view recycling or pro-environmental activity as feminine or maybe even gay and that that's bad, then we have some work to do in that regard. So where do I ask Rowan this question? Where do you start with this? Where does the education start with helping boys become men who aren't worried that recycling is gay or feminine, even if they are straight men?
It obviously begins at a very, very young age within the context of what I think of Celia.
Yeah, Celia.
But in terms of generational, we do see, even within the fatherhood research that I do, you do see that younger fathers are more egalitarian in terms of tasks sharing with their partners. So within that context, you will probably see as generations go on, you might have less of these different specific tasks for male-female. But it does start very, very young with boys and girls. I mean, it's really that idea of socialization, that how is it that those parents want to, because basically socialization is just creating mini-me's. I mean, you're just trying to push your values, your morals onto the next generation. And so therefore, depending on how we do that, and maybe within the context of having our society push us in that way also, that determines what it looks like. But it definitely starts when around 3 years old and you start to understand those different aspects and you get reinforced through the, you know, boys don't cry when they fall, or girls, you look pretty
in
your dress.
If those things get baked in pretty early.
Absolutely.
It's kind of hard to undo. I mean, it's certainly not impossible, but hard to undo?
Very hard, very difficult, especially when you're getting the reinforcement from the society.
Well, here's a little pushback a different perspective from Amrita, who writes, Evan, two thoughts. During the rise of environmentalist movements in the 1960s and 1970s, it was a deliberate strategy by conservative opponents to paint male environmentalists as frivolous and feminine in order to discredit them. If they weren't real men, they didn't have to be taken seriously. It's no surprise, then, that, number two, she says, some feminists, women, and environmentalists have also themselves created a deliberate link between femininity and motherhood and the earth. This idea that women have an inherent connection between their bodies and the earth that men don't because of the way they produce and nurture life. This is not good because of how it promotes a biological essentialist view of gender, but on the other hand, it has been a powerful theme for social movements around the world. I'm thinking especially of the Love Canal protests in Niagara Falls in the 70s, led by mothers who wanted to both protect their children and the earth from industrial pollution. So that's from Amrita. There's a lot there. Is there concern about overly linking motherhood and the earth as biologically essentialist and excluding of men?
I mean, sure. I think that, you know, that can be a whole another hour of kind of how do we, you know, consider what motherhood is and what, you know, what a woman's body can and cannot do, or what a man's body can and cannot do, and what that looks like and all of those other things. So I think that there's obviously, slight pause when you see that, you know, women are mothers connected to the earth. Men can never understand these things. I think that that does get to a biological essentialist kind of perspective of gender. Like she said, it's been an incredibly effective tool, you know, and kind of going back to what we've been talking about, that, you know, women are seen as the caretakers. Jane mentioned that in her phone call as well. They do the unpaid work, the unglorified work, the work without status. And that's been, I think, used very effectively in these sorts of movements as well, to say, like, you know, mothers do this because they care, right? Mm-hmm. They're not going to get the glory out of this. They're not going to be the people, you know, leading the organizations, but they're going to get the job done. They're going to fix the planet. They're going to save it for their children, because men don't care as much. And so I think that if we can make it so that, you know, you're probably not going to get a trophy for recycling, but you should do it anyway. If we can get people to agree that they should be able to do those sorts of things, I think that we'll be able to make some sort of progress.
And same-sex couples are really pushing all of these aspects that we're talking about. because now you start thinking about mothering and fathering with same-sex couples. So that they're really pushing the envelope with all of this discussion we're having today.
In a positive direction.
In a positive direction.
Okay. Before we let the hour go, Peter Bartula, President of Computer Systems Asset Disposal. Where can people find you? And, you know, upcycle with you.
Yes, upcycling is definitely much better for the environment. People don't realize that it takes more energy to smelt something down in its component metals than it does to create the computer in the first place. We're in Gates on Industrial Park Circle. Any person can bring their computers to us, but we've grown over 500% in the last 4 years because just about every major corporation and organization in Rochester realizes that upcycling and reuse is a much better concept than recycling. And we also pay them significant amounts because of that, because we're able to resell the equipment at a high amount versus getting scrap value.
So real quick,
recycling.
People bring what to you? Old computers? What else?
Anything but CRTs. We call it anything with a board or a cord.
Anything with a board or a cord at Computer Systems Asset Disposal. It's non-gendered upcycling. And if you want to get involved with the Citizens Climate Lobby or related organizations, Jim, what would you tell people to do?
Check out citizensclimatelobby.org and on the website and sign up. We have local chapter, and we have chapters in every congressional district, pretty much in the country. So it's a national organization. We're trying to get our government to take a step to really make a difference, to move along the fight to the climate change.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for saying yes and joining us here. Rowan Collins, nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here. Peter Bartula, thank you, Peter. And Dr. Primus, thank you, Professor. Thank you very much for being here.
Absolutely.
Short break, more connections coming up.